Okay, he said. I'll do my best. In Yellow Springs, we slipped into the hospital entrance lane and slowed over the speed bumps, nosed around to the lot in back, parked near the morgue door. I didn't want to go inside. Joe was still in there. I started to think vaguely about funeral arrangements. I'd never had to do it before. The Marine Corps handled my father's. Joe arranged my mother's. But I got out of the car with the two of them, and we walked through the chill air to the door, found our way back to the shabby office. The same doctor was at the desk, still in a white coat, still looking tired. He waved us in, and we sat down. I took one of the stools. I didn't want to sit next to the fax machine again. The doctor looked at all of us in turn. We looked back at him.
What have you got for us? Finley said.
The tired man at the desk prepared to answer, like preparing for a lecture. He picked up three files from his left and dropped them on his blotter, opened the top one, pulled out the second one, and opened that, too.
Morrison, he said, Mr. and Mrs.
He glanced around the three of us again. Finley nodded to him.
Tortured and killed, the pathologist said. The sequence is pretty clear. The woman was restrained. Two men, I'd say, one on each arm, gripping and twisting. Heavy bruising on the forearms and the upper arms. Some ligament damage from twisting the arms up her back. Obviously, the bruising continued to develop from the time she was first seized until the time she died. The bruising stops developing when the circulation stops. You understand?
We nodded. We understood.
I'd put it at about 10 minutes, he said. 10 minutes, beginning to end. So, the woman was being held. The man was being nailed to the wall. I'd guess both were naked by then. They were in nightwear before the attack, right?
Robes, Finley said. They were having breakfast.
Okay. The robes came off early on, the doctor said. The man was nailed to the wall. Technically, to the floor also, through the feet. His genital area was attacked. The scrotum was severed. Postmortem evidence suggests that the woman was persuaded to swallow the amputated testicles.
The office was silent, silent as a tomb. Roscoe looked at me, stared at me for a while. Then she looked back at the doctor.
I found them in her stomach, the doctor said.
Roscoe was as white as the guy's coat. I thought she was going to pitch forward off her stool. She closed her eyes and hung on. She was hearing about what somebody had planned for us last night.
And? Finley said.
The woman was mutilated, the doctor said. Breasts severed, genital area attacked, throat cut. Then the man's throat was cut. That was the last wound inflicted. You could see the arterial spray from his neck overlaying all the other bloodstains in the room.
There was dead silence in the room. Lasted quite a while. Weapons? I asked. The guy at the desk swiveled his tired gaze toward me.
Something sharp, obviously, he said, a slight grin. Straight, maybe 5 inches long?
A razor? I said.
Nah, he said. Certainly something as sharp as a razor, but rigid, not folding, and double-edged.
Why? I said.
There's evidence it was used back and forth, the guy said.
He swished his hand back and forth in a tiny arc.
Like this, on the woman's breasts, cutting both ways like filleting a salmon.
I nodded. Roscoe and Finley were silent.
What about the other guy? I said.
Stoller? The pathologist pushed the two Morrison files to one side and opened up the third, glanced through it and looked across at me. The third file was thicker than the first two.
His name was Stoller, he said. We've got him down as John Doe.
Roscoe looked up.
We sent you a fax, she said. Yesterday morning we traced his prints.
The pathologist rooted around on the messy desk, found a curled up fax, read it and nodded, crossed out John Doe on the folder and wrote in Sherman Stoller, gave us his little grin again.
I've had him since Sunday, he said. Been able to do a more thorough job, you know.
A bit chewed up by the rats, but not pulped like the first guy, and altogether a lot less mess than the Morrisons.
So what can you tell us? I said.
We've talked about the bullets, right? He said. Nothing more to add about the exact cause of death.
So what else do you know? I asked him.
The file was too thick for just the shooting and running and bleeding to death bits. This guy clearly had more to tell us.
I saw him put his fingers on the pages and press lightly, like he was trying to get vibrations or read the file in Braille.
He was a truck driver, he said.
He was? I said.
I think so, the guy said.
Sounded confident. Finley looked up. He was interested. He loved the process of deduction. It fascinated him. Like when I'd scored with those long shots about Harvard, his divorce, quitting smoking.
Go on, he said.
Okay, briefly, the pathologist said. I found certain persuasive factors. A sedentary job because his musculature was slack, his posture poor, flabby buttocks, slightly rough hands, a fair bit of old diesel fuel ingrained in the skin. Also, traces of old diesel fuel on the soles of his shoes. Internally, a poor diet, high in fat, plus a bit too much hydrogen sulfide in the blood gases and the tissues. This guy spent his life on the road, sniffing other people's catalytic converters. I make him a truck driver because of the diesel fuel.
Finley nodded. I nodded. Stoller had come in with no ID, no history, nothing but his watch. This guy was pretty good. He watched us nod our approval, looked pleased, looked like he had more to say.
But he's been out of work for a while, he said.
Why? Finley asked him.
Because all that evidence is old, the doctor said. Looks to me like he was driving a lot for a long period, but then he stopped. I think he's done very little driving for 9 months, maybe a year. So I make him a truck driver, but an unemployed truck driver.
Okay, Doc. Good work, Finley said. You got copies of all that for us?
The doctor slid a large envelope across the desk. Finley stepped over and picked it up. Then we all stood up. I wanted to get out. I didn't want to go back to the cold store again. I didn't want to see any more damage.
Roscoe and Finley sensed it and nodded. We hustled out like we were 10 minutes late for something. The guy at the desk let us go. He'd seen lots of people rushing out of his office like they were 10 minutes late for something.
We got into Roscoe's car. Finley opened the big envelope and pulled out the stuff on Sherman's stroller, folded it into his pocket.
That's ours for the time being, he said. It might get us somewhere.
I'll get the arrest report from Florida, Roscoe said, and we'll find an address for him somewhere. Gotta be a lot of paperwork on a trucker, right? Union, medical, licenses? Should be easy enough to do.
We rode the rest of the way back to Margrave in silence. The station house was deserted, apart from the desk guy. Lunch break in Margrave, lunch break in Washington, D.C., same time zone. Finley handed me a scrap of paper from his pocket and stood guard on the door to the Rosewood office. I went inside to call the woman who may have been my brother's lover. The number Finley had handed me reached Molly Beth Gordon's private line. She answered on the first ring. I gave her my name. It made her cry.
You sound so much like Joe, she said.
I didn't reply. I didn't want to get into a whole lot of reminiscing. Neither should she, not if she was stepping out of line and was in danger of being overheard. She should just tell me what she had to tell me and get off the line.
So what was Joe doing down here? I asked her. I heard her sniffing, and then her voice came back clear.
He was running an investigation,
she said.
Into what? I don't know specifically.
But what sort of a thing? I asked her. What was his job?
Don't you know?
She said. No, I said. We found it very hard to keep in touch, I'm afraid. You'll have to start from the beginning for me. There was a long pause on the line.
Okay,
she said.
I shouldn't tell you this, not without clearance, but I will. It was counterfeiting. He ran the Treasury's anti-counterfeiting operation.
Counterfeiting, I said. Counterfeit money?
Yes,
she said.
He was head of the department, ran the whole show. He was an amazing guy, Jack.
But why was he down here in Georgia? I asked her.
I don't know,
she said.
I really don't. What I aim to do is find out for you. I can copy his files. I know his computer password.
There was another pause. Now I knew something about Molly Beth Gordon. I'd spent a lot of time on computer passwords. Any military cop does. I'd studied the psychology. Most users make bad choices. A lot of them write the damn word on a post-it note and stick it on the monitor case. The ones who are too smart to do that use their spouse's name or their dog's name or their favorite car or ball player or the name of the island where they took their honeymoon or balled their secretary. The ones who think they're really smart use figures, not words. But they choose their birthday or their wedding anniversary or something pretty obvious. If you can find something out about the user, you've normally got a better than even chance of figuring their password. But that would never work with Joe. He was a professional. He'd spent important years in military intelligence. His password would be a random mixture of numbers, letters, punctuation marks, upper and lower case. His password would be unbreakable. If Molly Beth Gordon knew what it was, Joe must have told her. No other way. He had really trusted her. He had been really close to her. So I put some tenderness into my voice. Molly, that would be great, I said. I really need that information.
I know you do,
she said.
I hope to get it tomorrow. I'll call you again soon as I can, soon as I know something.
Is there counterfeiting going on down here? I asked her. Is that what this could be all about?
No,
she said.
It doesn't happen like that. Not inside the States. All that stuff about little guys with green eye shades down in secret cellars printing dollar bills is all nonsense. Just doesn't happen. Joe stopped it. Your brother was a genius, Jack. He set up procedures years ago for the special paper sales and the inks, so if anybody starts up, he gets nailed within days. 100% foolproof. Printing money in the States just doesn't happen anymore. Joe made sure of that. It all happens abroad. Any fakes we get here are shipped in. That's what Joe spent his time chasing. International stuff. Why he was in Georgia, I don't know. I really don't. But I'll find out tomorrow. I promise you that.
I gave her the station house number and told her to speak to nobody except me or Roscoe or Finley. Then she hung up in a hurry like somebody had just walked in on her. I sat for a moment and tried to imagine what she looked like. Teal was back in the station house, and old man Kleiner was inside with him. They were over by the reception counter, heads together. Kleiner was talking to Teal like I'd seen him talking to Eno at the diner. Foundation business, maybe. Roscoe and Finley were standing together by the cells. I walked over to them, stood between them, and talked low.
Counterfeiting, I said. This is about counterfeit money. Joe was running the Treasury Department's defense for them. You know anything about that sort of a thing down here? Either of you?
They both shrugged and shook their heads. I heard the glass door suck open, looked up. Kleiner was on his way out. Teal was starting in toward us.
I'm out of here, I said.
I brushed past Teal and headed for the door. Kleiner was standing in the lot next to the black pickup, waiting for me. He smiled, wolf's teeth showing.
Sorry for your loss, he said. His voice had a quiet, cultured tone, educated, a slight hiss on the sibilance, not the voice to go with his sunbaked appearance.
You upset my son, he said.
He looked at me, something burning in his eyes. I shrugged.
The kid upset me first, I said.
How?
Kleiner asked, sharply.
He lived and breathed, I said.
I moved on across the lot. Kleiner slid into the black pickup, fired it up and nosed out. He turned north, I turned south. Started the walk down to Roscoe's place. It was a half mile through the new fall chill. 10 minutes at a brisk pace. I got the Bentley out of the garage, drove it back up the slope to town, made the right onto Main Street and cruised along. I was peering left and right in under the smart striped awnings, looking for the clothes store. Found it 3 doors north of the barber shop. Left the Bentley on the street and went in. Paid out some of Charlie Hubble's expenses cash to a sullen, middle-aged guy for a pair of pants, a shirt, and a jacket. A light fawn color, pressed cotton, as near to formal as I was prepared to go. No tie. I put it all on in the changing cubicle in the back of the store, bagged up the old stuff, and threw it in the Bentley's trunk as I passed. I walked the 3 doors south to the barber shop. The younger of the 2 old guys was on his way out of the door. He stopped and put his hand on my arm.
"What's your name, son?"
he asked me. No reason not to tell him, not that I could see. "Jack Reacher," I said.
"You got any Hispanic friends in town?"
"No," I said.
"Well, you got some now," he said. 2 guys looking all over for you."
I looked at him. He scanned the street. "Who were they?" I asked him.
Never saw them before," the old man said. "Little guys, brown car, fancy shirts. Been all over asking for Jack Reacher. We told him we never heard of no Jack Reacher."
"When was this?" I said.
"This morning," he said. "After breakfast."
I nodded.
"Okay,"
I said. "Thanks." The guy held the door open for me.
"Go right in," he said. "My partner will take care of you. But he's a bit skittish this morning, getting old."
"Thanks," I said again. "See you around."
Sure hope so, son," he said.
He strolled off down Main Street, and I went inside his shop. The older guy was in there, the gnarled old man whose sister had sung with Blind Blake. No other customers. I nodded to the old guy and sat down in his chair.
"Good morning, my friend,"
he said. "You remember me?" I said.
"Sure do," he said. "You are our last customer. Nobody in between to muddle me up."
I asked him for a shave, and he set about whipping up the lather. "I was your last customer?" I said. "That was Sunday. Today is Tuesday. Business always that bad?" The old guy paused and gestured with the razor.
"Been that bad for years," he said. "Old Mayor Teal won't come in here. And what the old mayor won't do, nobody else white will do neither. Except old Mr. Gray from the station house came in here regular as clockwork, 3-4 times a week, until he went and hung himself, God rest his soul. You're the first white face in here since last February, yes, sir, that's for sure.